Hey everybody, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And we take 30 minutes on a good movie and 30 minutes on a bad movie. And this week's bad movie, which we're discussing first, is Bad Magic. This is directed by a directorial brother duo called the Polonia Brothers. They made a lot of direct-to-video horror movies through the 90s, and one of the two brothers passed away a few years ago, but they actually continued through the 2000s as well, and I don't quite know how I never caught one of their movies or even heard more about them, because I remember seeing these like in Blockbusters and stuff, and you know, they're very obviously very poorly shot on video, very cheaply, and they were just sort of ground out. There are a lot of Polonia Brothers movies, and we just sort of selected this one at random. It came out in 97, after, one, I think, 1 or 2 years after Feeders, which was like an aliens in space movie, and apparently the number one blockbuster independent movie rental of that year. So they must have been really encouraged by that. Not quite sure how they got their stuff into stores, because in the 80s, perhaps, I could see that, but I think, like, by at least the mid-90s, there were, you know, the studios were getting, had gotten into direct-to-video movies in, you know, more and more. Stuff that's this staggeringly incompetent and on every level is really hard to imagine that it got on the shelves. I was sort of awestruck that, not so much like because this movie is so horrible. I think I've seen movies that are this poorly made, but they were made by people who were never heard from again. The breadth of these guys' filmography puts the balance between their lack of talent and their apparent business brilliance, like, more far exceeding the level of like Uwe Boll in terms of that gap.
Oh, I mean, there's no, Uwe Boll has investors. I don't think that these guys have investors. One of the things about Bad Magic is they thank the New York Film Commission at the end, and I was really surprised that that was original footage. I figured they kind of bought it from some clip tape, because the movie seems to take it. Yeah, there's inner cut. You know, there's
the editing is really something. It there's a cut every few seconds, and there's a lot of power of suggestion, you could say, a lot of implication through rapid editing of, you know, what looks like stock footage from a VHS tape.
And speaking of them getting their stuff into stores, what's really interesting about it is the copyright at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know anything about this, but every time I've ever seen a copyright, it tells you who the copyright owner is.
Mm-hmm.
The end of Bad Magic does not tell you who the copyright owner is. It just says copyright 1997, all rights reserved. And none of their stuff, or very few of their films, are available on DVD. And even finding them for this, we couldn't even find the one I really wanted, which was the they did a Planet of the Apes knockoff right after Planet of the Apes, the remake, came out, and I wanted to watch that, and it's, you know, apparently impossible to find. But, yeah.
Well, the good news is the Polonia Brothers are still making films, and they have documented themselves at Cinegraphic Productions, LLC, that is cinegraphicprod.com. Cinegraphic Prod. It's an offshoot production company of Polonia Brothers Entertainment, and it's dedicated to the memory of John Polonia.
And if you think about it, they've made more movies than the Wachowski brothers. and they got started before them. I think that'd be funny to, for someone, I don't know, in a magazine that would, you know, make people notice it, to compare the Wachowski brothers and the Hughes brothers to the Polonia brothers. Just because, I mean, this is shot on video.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like something that, you know,
it's indistinguishable from someone's home movie. It basically is someone's home movie, except
it came out in a video store that someone's been to. There was a video box. It's just kind of, and it's so bad that I think I saw some comment compare it to Ed Wood. And then, of course, it can't, because Ed Wood had some sort of passion to it, which brings up this really strange idea of what if the Polonia brothers had a passion for this movie, which is, is the hooker a guy in drag?
I thought so for, like, most of it. There were a couple of shots, though, where I was like, is that just a fat, ugly woman? But no, I was pretty sure it was a man in drag. And
yeah, thought,
like, did they not know any women for this movie? Or is this like Shakespeare where you can't have women? It's inexplicable.
There was one woman in another scene, but I think it was for the simulated sex. They had to get a guy to do it. And it really does. It doesn't have any sets. I don't know if you noticed at the end, they returned to that shed that they had sort of walked past in another shot. And that's the best part, is it's filmed in, you know, somewhat rural Pennsylvania, but it's supposed to be in New York. So you'll have, you know, the skyscraper shots cut to some guy walking through the forest, basically.
Well, speaking of the sets, I liked Tobunga, the voodoo guy's voodoo lair. It looks like a public access interview set up with lawn chairs. There's a nice plant and some blue drapes, which are probably the same drapes they used for the blue screen later. When, like, what's the main character's name?
Oh, I can't remember.
I remember his friend's name is Amos, so
that's,
I guess,
his brother.
I guess he's Zandy. There's that thing where he, like, flies across space when he's astral projecting himself as a poltergeist to the leather engineer and accounting firm gang, terrorizing their house.
IMDb doesn't have the. Well, the other thing is the bad guy's lair appears to be an unfinished house. That was really cool. IMDb actually does not have any of the character names except one.
I noticed that, yeah.
So we're in trouble. It could be Rennie. That's possible. The Polonia Brothers official website does not have any pages on the movies. It just has links to the IMDb page, where they're very proud they got onto IMDb, apparently. it is kind of interesting because it's so... all the bad guys are white, which I thought was funny. The badass
they're white and from Jersey,
and they're overweight and stupid. And, you know, it's just like
it actually is kind of delightful at times. I'm sure it's more fun watching this with other people, which might be the secret of the theater's success. Maybe there was kind of a word of mouth, you got to see this bad movie thing going for feeders. Sometimes it really is like gigglingly bad. And, you know, I mean, for a movie that's only an hour long, it's there's still an endurance element to getting through it. On the other hand, if, you know, with a few beers, probably a lot better. Maybe.
I think having other people around to sort of share in the, like, I kept.
And maybe as far as the Polonia brothers go, they've got the ultimate, you know, they've got the ultimate in that inebriated, so bad it's good experience. Like the one about the dinosaurs that you were talking about. Like Attack on Dinosaur Island or something.
Okay, it is Rennie. Rennie is the main character. Rennie's brother Amos. The gang, the vicious New York gang, is called the Red Claws, which is never explained why they're called the Red Claws. But then at one point, Rennie's voodoo magic gives him a white claw that he uses to tear up somebody's picture, I think.
How great was Rennie's narration during the first 15 minutes or so?
To explain to us all the important stuff. It was, it's just, because, I mean, most...
You could sort of hear him waiting as his eyes went to the next line on the script before he started talking again during that narration.
There's, you kind of think that you can't understand watching this that they thought that this guy was giving a good performance. Like, there's just no way they thought this guy was good. There's no way they thought any of them were good. I mean, how could they, really? I mean, like...
Yeah, I know what you mean about it. Minus the passion, because Ed Wood was a one-take director, but he told everybody to oversell it, pretty much. There's sort of a lot of underselling in the Bad Magic.
Oh, and let's not forget the special effects, which were apparently made on your, you know, high school's VHS title maker. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it's just, I mean, it's...
It literally has the kind of transitions where, like, everything turns into squares.
Oh, wait, what about the video game music when people fade away? It goes, doo-doo-doo, doo-doo-doo, doo-doo-doo.
Yeah, it kind of makes Atari noises when Rennie astral projects himself too.
I mean, it's just
all the voodoo stuff.
The funny thing is, the music actually, even though it's bad, seems like it was somewhat competently recorded.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I was thinking like, I've heard kind of atonal shitty music like this, but I've heard it in movies that were better than this.
Yeah, I mean, the music's fine.
And,
yeah.
And this music, and the shitty music, is the best part.
And it's just like, I mean, it kind of reminded me of the incompetence of a, not even really a student film, because they were going to get graded. So it's kind of like an hour long, I don't know, like if you and your friends got together and decided to make a movie type thing.
It's a home movie, I mean, but... If they're all sort of home movies, I don't know. Maybe this is like one of their B features. I mean, they have so many titles to their credit that maybe they have sort of their A productions, like Feeders to Sleigh Bells, which I think is set during Christmas, and it came out after this one. And then in between their A features, if they can stay at their aunt's house for the weekend, they'll make a movie at their aunt's house in Pennsylvania. With some rubber demon masks. It reminded me of making home movies myself, and it kind of made me nostalgic for it, for the time when I could think, like, yeah, I've got a rubber zombie mask. I could make a zombie movie. So what if the mask is rubber? Except, sees the power of imagination.
Somehow you didn't get your movies into Blockbuster, though.
Well, yeah.
That's what the unfortunate thing is that, you know, we don't know who released the VHS tape, like, what pedigree of video company did this. And it's kind of, the 90s were sort of, that's why I'm surprised their stuff isn't available on DVD, because I always thought that doing direct-to-DVD was even cheaper than doing direct-to-video, because the 90s was sort of when direct-to-video got big.
Mm-hmm.
In lots of ways. Just, I was just thinking the other day about the Whoopi Goldberg dinosaur movie that, you know, what is it, Danny Rex or whatever?
Theodore Rex,
the $35 million.
Whoopi Goldberg teams up with Earl Sinclair, cop, buddy cop comedy.
And it was supposed to be theatrical, and it just didn't happen, and... So I think New Line shot it onto video. Well, okay, Feeders 2, though it does run 80 minutes, has absolutely no one in it who submitted a picture to IMDb, or had their agent submit a picture to IMDb. So I think the Polonia Brothers is kind of like, I don't know,
mom and pop outfit all the way.
Apparently, though, it played in a Feeders 2 at least played in a film festival, according to this one guy's review. But yeah, it's.
I think I need to see a few more of these movies just to get the breadth of.
I think I got us at least Dinosaur Chronicles, and Dweller.
Okay, we'll do one of those after next week's.
But anyway, yeah. So, okay, wait, hold on. They did actually work with Jeff Dylan Graham, who's got a picture on IMDb. But yeah, so it's
You know, the Ed Wood comparison. Like, I finally bought a copy of Nightmare of Ecstasy, which Tim Burton's Ed Wood was based on, and the kind of word of mouth. Oral history of the production of bad movies is always pretty fascinating. If anyone wants to do a movie of the Polonia Brothers, I think, you know, the dramatic chapters are already set with one of them's passing, and the rags to riches element, and the kind of riding on the last vestige of the last wave of being original video hits, having those as a no budget production company.
Well, and this is totally different even than Full Moon, which did a lot in the 90s because of cheaper overseas shooting. And
yeah, I mean, it's sort of, maybe we're not emphasizing it enough, but this is really like, but in terms of budget, I mean, sub Troma, sub.
I honestly don't think this movie.
Sub anything you could imagine, pretty much.
I mean, do you think it cost $200 to produce it? Like, not the music. The music, I'm sure, you know, cost something. But, like, actually walking around on the street, et cetera, do I believe they really had film permits? Like, I don't know. They didn't have any location shooting anywhere.
Yeah, I don't think they notified anyone at the airport when they were getting a shot of a plane taking off, for instance.
I mean, it's just like...
It just feels like they walked there and you can feel the camera jostling at the guy's arm.
Yeah, the street scenes, you know, when there are no cars in the shot.
Yeah.
The most expensive thing would have been the sound effects, you know, CDs that they used to get their sound effects, their, you know, the car noises off of. I mean, it was just so cheap that the only it's kind of like, I mean, it's somewhat, I guess, impressive that, no, it's not. I was going to try and, I mean,
I know what you mean about the lack of passion, like, compared to Ed Wood, because there doesn't seem to be anything, like, inspired or personal. But they might have some personal stuff in their other movies. And, I mean, the number of movies they made makes me suspect that they really just... They really don't know how bad they are. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made as many titles as they have.
But there's the internet now. People say they're bad all the time. I guess they're not Fred Decker. I guess they don't Google themselves. But,
Fred Decker's of an older time. And when you still open the New York Mirror and read your film review or whatever...
These guys, I'm sure, were never reviewed. Seriously, how much do you think this cost? I mean, just to produce it, not any of the post-production.
I'm trying to think if they paid their actors.
No, I think those are their friends. And at least one of them was one of the Polonia brothers, maybe two of them. Because the cast list only has like 7 people in it. And if you get rid of the 2 black guys...
Yeah.
There were the 2 brothers who fight the zombie, and then there's, or whatever those guys were. I kind of forgot about that sequence. Wasn't it like 10 minutes of these guys chasing a zombie for no reason? Or a demon chasing them? Yeah.
Zombie chasing them. It's the corpse of Amos.
Well, no, that wasn't the corpse of Amos. The corpse of Amos was at the end, and it was a white guy wearing a black mask with an afro. A black zombie mask with an afro, but he was a white guy. I found odd.
Yeah, you're right. That's not the demon.
The demon's the servant, or
He has some ridiculous, unpronounceable name like McKee Bouquet.
Ah, Bouquet Bouquet. Yeah.
Bouquet Bouquet. You can't tell what he's supposed to be called.
It's great because when they say it all the time,
and it's different every time. McKee Bouquet.
Yeah, no, I can't believe they would have paid those guys. And I mean,
I guess it cost under $1,000 then.
Oh, yeah. The videotape.
That would about cover it, I think. And the production, but the post-production, by comparison, it's so well edited. There's so many awesome cuts to stuff.
Yeah, but they did that on the two VCRs.
Awesome stuff like snakes and Rennie holding the plastic cleaver that I think I also bought at Spencer's Gifts when I was making home slasher movies.
I think the post-production, most of it, though, was done with their two tape decks.
Yeah.
And they were playing back on one and pausing the other.
Yeah, but they worked the hell out of them. I mean,
they did. It must have been...
Changed the heads after that.
They probably returned them to the store and said they're defective.
I think they have... Yeah.
if they were
Ed Wood, they might get a special, like, I'd like to think that these guys like struggle like Ed Wood to come up with the money for all this stuff, but they're more prolific than Ed Wood.
I guess they're
the ultimate evidence that, like, we live in the video age where anyone can truly make something that technically qualifies as a movie. And if video had been around...
We check to see if this has an MPAA rating? Did you check?
No.
Oh, I'm going to check. I guess that would technically be the real thing, is that it was submitted for an MPAA rating, right?
Well, let's see. Bad Magic. I don't see a rating.
But we got to talk about the bad guys, Ajax and the other fat, white... The fat... middle-aged white bad guys.
Uh-huh.
The toughest gang in New York.
Well, they've all got leather jackets. Come on. Bandanas and shades.
They all wear their hats backwards. Did you notice that?
They're like rapists in a karaoke video that gets played in the booth. It's pre-recorded music video.
And then, of course, the hooker. They have one. The gang has one hooker that apparently is responsible for all their income. Except it's a guy in a blonde wig.
Yeah, transvestism.
The funniest thing was that there's the shot of the hooker at the beginning, when he's going through his stuff, and I'm kind of like, nope, it's not MPAA rated, so I don't know if that technically qualifies. So, it was submitted to the MPAA.
Yeah.
Was there bad language in it? I think there was, right? Can't really remember.
No, it was pretty mild bad language. I think those tough engineers sitting around the half-modeled kitchen were like, you know, you go to hell, you goddamn jerk. It was pretty...
And then there's like this really weird scene with one of the guys on the toilet.
You'd say it has a quiet moralism. I mean, the guy ends up in hell at the end.
That's true, and I realized that he was going
for making the Faustian bargain, and the last lines of the movie almost sound like a made-up Bible verse or something about, you know, he who seeks revenge is already damned to hell.
The guy in the toilet reading the famous monsters of movie land, though, I don't think they had permission to use that shot. And they also have, like, Coca-Cola in it or Marlboro. Did you notice that? And I'm kind of like, they didn't have permission to do that, like,
yeah,
because it's like, what's a good example?
They didn't write Forrest J. Ackerman and ask permission.
It's like the end of Clerks is a good example of that, when you have the entire convenience store and you can't read any of the labels because they were worried about somehow getting sued. I guess the Plonia brothers don't worry about getting sued.
Yeah, they're not worried like Alex Cox was in Repo Man, making the generic food labels.
Okay, so where else to go with this?
I don't know. Do you you ever seen the Mystery Science Theater movie Hobgoblins?
No.
Well, That was made by a guy named Rick Sloan. He also made a series of direct-to-video movies in the 80s called the Vice Academy films.
I think I remember those being on USA Up All Night.
Yeah, they were, and they had the, some of them had like Linnea Quigley and Ginger Lynn, and the Polony brothers make that guy look like Michael Ritchie when it comes to like the deft handling. I think those were the most competent movies I've seen in a long time, but I have a new standard now, so I guess I'm glad I saw a Polony brothers movie now, because I feel like my scope of knowledge of amateurism has been expanded a bit.
Yeah, the possibility of cinema is
the power of suggestion.
I don't know. I watched all of Bad Magic. I didn't watch all of Layer Cake. I mean,
do you think this would have been scary if you were like 4 years old?
Four years old.
I was trying to think of how young you'd have to be for this to be remotely scary. And I guess like somebody wearing a crappy mask walking towards, you know, the movie, the much heralded bad movie, Troll 2, the unrelated Italian direct video sequel filmed as goblins to Charles Band's Empire Entertainment's Troll 2 has masks that are like the masks in Bad Magic. They're obviously rubber and they don't move and the camera just lingers on them, but Troll 2 is filmed like a real movie.
Well, that's because
This movie helps me understand the difference between an amateur movie and a real movie more than, that's what it teaches me about amateurism.
Yeah.
Like, I understand that divide a little better now.
The thing about
for all the low budget, like, what are some other, like, shot on video, what are some shot on video movies that are, like, more like real movies? I guess, like, Even Hitler Had a Girlfriend? You ever heard of that one?
No.
That was like a video. That was a like shot on video in Austin, Texas, over a a few weeks, and it has like this Corman-esque wit to it.
Just anything, because this is half inch video they shot this on, so you know it's not like it was 98. There would have been. It wasn't shot on high eight. The colors are too bad. High
How
eight.
Is it? Colors are so bad. I swear to God, like it looks like 98 more than 98. It's so washed out.
The video camera they were using was from like 92, and it was one of those big clunky shoulder ones. Because mm-hmm. It's definitely, you know, they bought their VHS tapes from their local pharmacy and popped it in and went back to the kitchen.
As far as the equipment they used, which is such like an immediate giveaway of the amateurism, I've still seen movies that were direct to video from like direct to video horror movies from the 80s shot with probably just about as bad equipment that
they
still
would have had lighting
which had lighting.
Yeah. Lighting helps. You can make DV look like film with the right lighting. You can't, you know, if you're gonna shoot on half inch video with no lighting, it's just with natural lighting, it's you're in trouble. And the best is the blood, because the blood's not red. And it's just like...
I liked when they worked the demon masks' mouths from inside and had them talk.
Okay, the demon mask thing was how I was going to talk about how old you'd have to be scared of this. It would be how old you were when you got scared of seeing... where you still got scared of Halloween masks on the shelf in the store.
Yeah.
Not even somebody having them in the context of it being a fluorescently lit supermarket rubber mask. If that scares you, Bad Magic would still scare you. Otherwise, there's no way, because it's...
So, the Polony brothers are making the best kids horror movies since Puppet Master.
On the other hand, that whole... the whole possibly transsexual prostitute, that might scare some kids. I mean, I was pretty scared. I was like, are they going to have like some terrible like sex scene where it's a dude in a bra? Like in a stuffed bra? And they didn't. They didn't even give me that, the Polonia brothers. They failed.
You can't be killing everyone. You're dead.
I think that's true. I think Dinosaur Island, though, in addition to having a giant spider that doesn't move, it also does have a female cave girl. So they apparently met a girl between 1998 and 2002.
Yeah, she was in the neighborhood that year.
Because there's no, you can't do anything with this. You're not going to appear on this if you want to appear on, you know, in a local commercial. Like,
yeah,
you can't make a clip reel from this. Like,
yeah, it would even kill your chances.
Like, if you were really down on your luck and you were one of those guys who was, you know, in the commercials at 2 in the morning for auto insurance, the local auto insurance guy, maybe if you were down on your luck and you needed some money, you'd put on the mask for this. But it's just, I wish people could see it, because, I mean, it is really, I don't know, it's... I think they ought to play this at Radio City Music Hall on that huge screen, blown up to a packed auditorium. Because I think
maybe it should be Feeders to Sleigh Bells, and they should play it on Christmas and have the Rockettes there.
Oh, that'd be awesome! See, people would, you know, it would bring people together.
I can't help but think that, like, because there are some of their other movies, like Feeders, take place in space and have, they have puppets too, you know. They might, because they take place in space, they might be a little bit more epic, or they might have had to fake a few more effects shots and done more things like, you know, drawing ray gun zaps on the frame the way they drew lightning. They sort of like cut lightning out in white onto a freezed frame of like an exterior place. And they drew lightning on in during one of the voodoo scenes.
Did you notice all the static shots they were using? Like, you know, the shot on pause?
Mm-hmm.
That was cool. The jitter from the pause really made it feel lifelike.
It's like you're watching the movie being edited as you watch it.
See, all I could think when I was watching this is we should have done a commentary on this thing. Like, I mean, everyone should. I don't know. It's, yeah.
Polonia Brothers, The Mystery Begins.
Yeah, we'll have to certainly return to these fine filmmakers, video makers at some point.
Mm-hmm. Videots. Yeah, there's a term that's gone out with VHS, man.
Can you imagine how bad it would look on, like, oh, wow, DVD, what? Just because a remastered, you know, like, running it at progressive and, like, cutting out every third, fourth frame or whatever because it was shot on video? Oh, man.
Remastered from the original SP tape.
Oh, and it could be, they could mat it to HD like Sam Raimi says he did for Evil Dead. Like,
Disney could re-release it in 3D.
Oh, wow. They could remake it with Ashton Kutcher and Bernie Mac. Okay, we're done. Our good movie this week is Yojimbo. The Kurosawa Yojimbo from 1961.
Mm-hmm.
Which you hadn't seen before, right?
Right. Yeah, I was looking forward to Shiro Mifune. Of course, him being so great in other Kurosawa movies like Throne of Blood and The Seven Samurai and Rashomon, the major works. And, you know, what I'd heard about this movie was that Mifune and Kurosawa helped create an archetypal character in, you know, the Yojimbo, which means bodyguard, this kind of man with no name. I've heard that he was a template for Sir Clint Eastwood and Sergio Leone's characterization of that character, and then, I don't know, you know, later down the line, Snake Plissken or whoever, but... that was true to an extent, but he is not, like, although his profession is basically mercenary, he is not. And it's never quite explained, but he basically arrives in this town as a mercenary by trade, but without letting on, he does good. He's a do-gooder. He wants to pit the crime families against each other simply to get rid of them, not even to get rich off of them. That sort of was revealed gradually to the other characters as well, I think, as someone seeing it for the first time, like I was. And that's what I found the most interesting about it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time, so I think I've seen the Fistful of Dollars is the Leone Eastwood one that's a direct remake of this.
Yeah.
And so I think I'd seen that a couple times in between, and there are a lot of, it's a pretty direct remake, except what I'd forgotten about Yojimbo is because it's not paced, I guess, like a Western movie. I mean, it introduces, there's no love interest or even cute girl in Yojimbo for the majority of the movie. And when there is a female character who shows up, that's not her role. And the Fistful of Dollars introduced her right away. And so did the Walter Hill remake, Last Man Standing, which...
With Bruce Willis.
With Bruce Willis. Excuse me.
Made about 96, 97.
96 or 97. It was Bruce Willis's biggest payday. It was a huge bomb. And I remember, and I wrote this in the response at the stop button. Walter Hill said he was going to improve on Kurosawa. He was talking to, you know, one of those cheesy Entertainment Tonight's or whatever, and he said, you know, Yojimbo's good, but, you know, it needs some work. And so this is what he was going to do. And that, the funny thing about Yojimbo is that it's not one of Kurosawa's serious works. It's a blockbuster. I mean, it's a comedy blockbuster, you know.
Yeah, it's got action and laughs.
It's like sitting there watching it. There's just the scenes where you're like, wow,
And it's not even like, you know, Seven Samurai has action and laughs, but it also has great drama and it's of an epic length. This is, this is 2 hours, but it's, you know, it's very peppy. It's very humorous. I wasn't expecting it to be humorous.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Because you sort of see the image of Mifune in his samurai garb and his sword. And his stoic expression, and you think it's going to be something more serious. But the thing is, even though he never breaks his stoic expression, except for once, and then it's a joke. It's a humorous movie for everything that's going on around him. And there's still some dramatic danger at the end. But most of it is, you know, quite funny throughout. Thanks a lot to like a lot of great secondary casting and supporting cast and Kurosawa's talent, sort of like John Ford or Preston Sturges, for casting a lot of mugs, you could say, like memorable faces in these sort of smaller parts, like the two goonie sons of the Ushitora clan, the one with the pistol, yeah. And the fat one with the monobrow,
who's a dimwit. He's supposed to be
right. He's a hilarious dimwit. Yeah,
he's great. I mean, it's just
yeah, he's fantastic.
And it's the kind of thing that, yeah, it's just during his scenes, you're sitting there going, "Wow!" And in an audience, it must have been great to see it. Probably not when it came out here in 61 or 62, because they cut it down to 75 minutes. And yeah, probably dubbed it, but you know, it's one of the few times I've been like, wow, I really wish I was, you know, I'd been sitting in a theater seeing this, because the audience reaction would have just been great, because it is really just so funny, some of the stuff they do. And then the bickering relationship between Mifune and the shopkeeper is it's really this, and this really plays out in the at least in A Fistful of Dollars too. They sort of lift it just as well, and they cast it just as well. It turns into this, you know, oddly touching, bickering sort of friendship type thing, and right. It's a lot of fun, and that's there really isn't much violence in Yojimbo though. Between the beginning and the end, there's not a high body count until the last act, really.
Yeah, and the violence is a combination of almost sort of musical choreography and bloodless death, like guys falling over, clutching their sides like they've been struck with swords, but we're not seeing blood spurt or anything. It's a combination of that, very elegantly choreographed, with actually a hands roll and arms roll. I think legs might have rolled too, but there's severed limbs. It's both extreme and highly theatrical in a bloodless way.
There's no glorification to Mifune being this great sword fighter either. Like, I'm trying to think of American movies around that era. He's not there's no hero moment for him where he sort of is able to, where there's supposed to be this visceral impact on the viewer of watching him commit mayhem on all the bad guys. There's just none of that. It's all very, the end fight scene is,
I guess even when he's doing heroic things and sword play figures into that, such as when he's rescuing the woman, bringing her to her husband and kid, and he has to go back to the building and kill a bunch of guys. It's sort of done very matter-of-factly, like he just needs to get it over with. The action doesn't slow down or anything.
They even spend more time with that on him setting up the scene for people to find it.
The violence happens pretty quickly and neatly, and convincingly, the way he handles a sword.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it happens in real time and we don't go into slow motion or anything like that would be the Tarantino glorification of the violence of the sword play. I thought the severed hand and leg or arm, which are both pretty early on in the movie, were sort of signifiers of a more modern approach. This was 61, and I think, 60 was a really watershed year tonally for movies between Psycho and some other things. But I'm not really thinking so much of violence as I am. Like, the music is, it's in feudal Japan, but the music kind of has a modern bent to it. It's somewhat jazzy at times. That's what made me think of some of the fight scenes as being a little musical-like, because there's very catchy beat going on, and there's trumpets, and there's harpsichord or organ, I think. Yeah, harpsichord. It's got a modern style for 61. I mean, it was at this time. Like, Kurosawa was making movies that were set in contemporary times that were sort of noirish movies, like The Bad Sleep Well came out the year before this, and I think Stray Dog the year or two before that. Movies set in modern Japan with modern gangsters, and they're sort of done the same stylistically. So even though this is a period piece, it doesn't have any, it has very little ornateness to it. People sort of get down dirty, but the, the only ornateness comes from the supporting cast and how sort of magical and Spielbergian they are. Like, or, I don't know, Lucas-like, you could say. Because you know how George Lucas, you know, the Star Wars movies are paced like sort of Kurosawa's adventure movies, and yeah. they have some comic relief from some lovable characters at just the right times.
And this really
yeah.
goes further with that, because the lovable characters are the villains in some ways, because they're just such buffoons.
That's true, yeah.
And so it's like there's the guards watching Mifune at one point are a giant guy and sort of a short, dumb guy. And, well, the giant guy's dumb, too. But they're just really funny because, you know, they're whining and complaining. And it's the music sort of clues you in. I don't know if it really clues you in early on, but maybe it does. That you're supposed to be enjoying this more than you are supposed to be, I mean, it's a blockbuster type thing. It has more in common with Iron Man, I would say, than it does with
It's like a fun romp. Yes, exactly. It's like a fun romp.
Yeah, and so it's just, and it's
And when the movie turns a little bit more serious towards the end, when Mifune's character is in trouble and he's on the run and his life is in danger, they never completely give up the. Because they sort of go for some suspense and some pathos where, you know, he needs the shopkeeper's help and stuff, and it's a bit touching that their friendship is is culminating like this. And then a little after that, you've got the monobrow idiot fat son doing some, you know, shows up again and says, you know, oh boy, you know, there's going to be another fight, and, you know, oops, I forgot this, and he waddles off. It's just a little bit of comic relief at the right time to keep the mood light, even when there's adventure. Again, like, yeah, what we know is the modern blockbuster, the Indiana Joneses, and et cetera.
And of course, you know, the thing is that Spielberg and Lucas, especially Lucas, I mean, he got the wipes from Star Wars, from Kurosawa stuff.
Oh, yeah, the horizontal wipes from scene to scene.
So, you know, they kind of came into that, and then everybody tried to mimic them. So there's a clear lineage back to Kurosawa. But one of the more interesting things is that watching this, it's Panavision, or it's Toho Scope, but it's 2.35, and you can kind of see the John Ford influence on it. Except the funny thing about that is John Ford isn't. I don't know if he ever shot that wide. And so it's kind of strange that of all the people who, you know, Kurosawa was the one who sort of was able to apply the, you know, wide open spaces that Ford did in, I'm thinking, Grapes of Wrath and maybe in Stagecoach, but he instead applied them to the Panavision frame. And it was just, it's really impressive. I think Kurosawa, if you haven't seen one before, it's really impressive to see what he was doing in, say, 61, because when you think about what was being made in the States in 61, what were they doing with Panavision here in 61? Even in 63 or 64?
Yeah, like,
still, you know,
the rogue or whatever.
Yeah, and it's just, if you go back further to Scandal, which was early 50s, it's just,
by comparison, like The Apartment in 1960 is like, it's like watching an adaptation of a play, the way they use the widescreen for, you know, just creating, showing you the big sets, basically, showing you big locations, and that's pretty much it.
And that might have something to do with, I guess, widescreen in the U.S. was introduced to convince people not to watch television. You know, that you couldn't see, you know, the 2.35 Panavision. You couldn't see that on your TV. I'm not sure if they had that same problem in Japan. But I'm thinking about something like The Great Escape, which does not, it has Panavision, but it does not resemble sort of modern direction in any way. Which
yeah, that wasn't until like 67 or something, yeah. Right?
So, I mean, it's just like the 60s are kind of big for that. And then, but when you see Kurosawa or, I'm trying to think of somebody else, Bergman, I mean, there's nothing in American, which sort of ties into our introduction for next week, but there's nothing like that in a popular American filmmaking. It's just interesting. And it seems like if you were trying to introduce someone who was resistant to seeing old movies, an older movie, you would almost go with Kurosawa before you would go with, you'd ease them into Delbert Mann.
No, it's a great place to start because, there's a stronger linkage between Asian film and American film than there is between American and European in some ways. And Kurosawa is part of that cultural exchange. Kurosawa, the modern feeling is the feeling that's, like you said, taken by Spielberg and Lucas and then imitated by them or from them, by everybody else. It's, even just the plotting and having bad guys who are kind of too humorous to be, well, but humorous and threatening or any balancing of the two, but also with kind of like, you know, goon characters that the hero has to deal with, and goons with gimmicks. You're talking about the fat idiot son, but the other son is a pretty good, like, not a main villain, but just a henchman character, you could say. This other son of the Ushitora clan that Mifune is gaming. He has a pistol. He's the only guy in the village with a pistol. And, like, in a movie it's another thing of Kurosawa being able to do, gun scenes and sword scenes in modern times or in feudal times, and here he gets to combine the two because when that character takes out his pistol, it changes the mood completely, and that's just his gimmick. He's just a goon with a gimmick, but he's excellent, and so too is from the other clan that Yojimbo is gaming against the other one, the Seibei clan. Seibei's wife, I thought, was fantastic and sort of just like really, really evil. There's that scene only sort of humorous because she's so evil in such a cold and matter-of-fact way. There's that scene where she's talking to her... She and her husband are convincing their son that their son has to kill Mifune when the job is done, and they don't know that he's sitting calmly outside the room, listening in while all the geishas are watching him, and like they overhear that he's going to be murdered, and he looks at him and he just winks, and it's like George Clooney does that kind of stuff. Like we're still doing that in the movies. We're still doing that that laugh in the face of death thing, but. Seibei's wife was great.
Yeah, they
and there is kind of a dark humor and that was being played for his parents telling their son that they have to you'll never be the head of a successful clan if people aren't afraid of you as a killer. People don't know that you're a killer.
She might be the most evil character in the whole movie. She has no sort of redeeming scenes at all.
Right.
I don't know if Walter Hill kept her for Last Man Standing. I don't know if he had the one family essentially being run by a woman. Leone did, but not. She wasn't in it as much. And it's just it's interesting to compare the two because Fistful of Dollars was made in Italy, but intended to come out here eventually. And Yojimbo, and so the plotting is, well, I don't really know, I guess, what regular Italian Western plotting would have been, but the way they introduce the guy with the gun, it's not like we hear about him from the first scene, which you do in Fistful of Dollars. You hear about him after he gets back. The woman, they have to explain to Mifune who the woman is and that whole thing, and it adds in all these other characters, because then it adds in this the situation with the mayor of the town and the propped up mayor of the town, and this is all stuff that we would traditionally expect to be in the first act, you know, to set up the thing. And they even set up the town in this really nice sequence where they go through the from the interior of the tavern. Mm. And they look out through those windows and they go, this is where that's going on, that's where that's going on. They don't even get into the whole thing with the mayor guys and the guy who was in Seven Samurai and Godzilla. I can't remember his name. But the guy who was keeping the mm-hmm. woman. Yeah. So it's just kind of interesting the way they plot that, and it's just, it feels very different, I guess, that you could expect your audience, a blockbuster audience, to be able to do this. I mean, to be able to follow this story, we certainly don't expect anything yeah. of them anymore.
Well, you know, the most fantastical element of the whole story is how Mifune is so cool and so calm at all times that he can always sort of play it as it lies, and he doesn't need to formulate anything. He has the feeling that he's making it up as he goes along, and everything he does turns out right, at least for a while. And it's just so, you know, like, you know, magical and impressive to see him get, like, the, you know, within the first 20 minutes or so, he's got the two gangs about to go to war in the street with each other because one thinks that they've got him on their side, and then he backed out at the last minute, and it's very whimsical. You know, but they hint at stuff and then follow up on it later, because I think during that, without any sense of urgency, the way Mifune doesn't have any real urgency to what he's doing, he's very sure of himself. Like during that introduction to the town sequence, I think the shopkeeper mentions that the mayor owns Silk Factory, and you hear minor mentions of things that show up again and are interconnected, like, you know, knowing about the sake, you know, the sake distillery or whatever, and then later seeing big barrels of sake being emptied. And it's like, you know, that must have taken a day to shoot, and it's just for a couple of shots, but it kind of ties everything. It makes the town feel like a, you know, community where the characters' lives really are interconnected in this place. Yeah. And Mifune is connecting the dots as this outsider.
And a lot of time passes in Yojimbo, really, because it rains for about a week, maybe even longer. And they can't do anything, and Mifune is upset, and the coffin maker's upset because they're not killing anybody because the you know, I guess it'd be the regional governors in town.
There's a Western touch. The eager owner of the local funeral parlor making his fortune off of oak and pine boxes. You know, just think of the Undertaker, I don't know, fitting Marty McFly for his coffin in Back to the Future 3 or something. An often dated, transplanted Western cliche.
I wonder if they got it from this, actually. I'm trying to think of any earlier...
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but it might just exist in both.
The town's also interesting because it's
shot like a Western.
Yeah,
in set, many many shots. The sequence I was just mentioning, where the two gangs are almost going to fight it out in the street. The streets are wide, and I mean, heck, when you see Mifune for the first time at the beginning of the movie, it looks like, you know, it's what Leone copies when he has Clint Eastwood walking down the dusty wide road in the middle of the town. It seems to stretch for miles in another direction.
Yeah, and the biggest difference is that Mifune's character isn't, you know, you mentioned he wasn't looking for profit, which you don't know at the beginning, but he's also just sort of aimlessly wandering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's mythical. They ask him his name, and he just makes something up.
Which is interesting, because you never would, I don't think, they didn't do that. They just avoided it in all the Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone ones. They just avoided ever naming him, as opposed to having the character say that his name didn't matter because nobody knew him and he wasn't going to be there for very long, which sort of introduces, you know, this whole commentary on the blockbuster itself is we're watching Toshirô Mifune as a samurai. Does it really matter what his name is? I mean,
yeah, what his past
really,
is.
Yeah, this isn't really important. What's going to happen is what's going to happen during this movie. And then, right. And it's kind of interesting that the most successful, I would say, sort of crowd pleasers generally follow that sort of sensibility, that what's important is what you do in your 2 hours, not what you imply about anything else, and not try and give weight to something that doesn't really need weight. I mean, just
I think Carpenter has said he likes you to not know much about your character, just have him appear at another, like cutting the bank robbery scene from the beginning of Escape from New York, so that Snake is just a guy without a past. Well, actually, you know what? Mifune is more of a guy without a past than Snake Plissken. He really is only comparable to the best remake of his character in this movie, A Fistful of Dollars, because Clint Eastwood comes out of nowhere as well. But then by being in sequels, he sort of becomes... Hey, wasn't there a sequel to Yojimbo?
There is. It's called Sanjuro.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen it, and I mean, I guess it's supposed to be all right. Same kind of approach to it. What's interesting is I was reading about it. The guy with the gun plays the main villain in Sanjuro. And the guy in Fistful of Dollars, whose name I can't... It's John, spelled G-I-A-N, something Valente, who plays this, the gun guy's role in Fistful of Dollars, plays the main villain in For a Few Dollars More, even though it's not a remake of Sanjuro. It's just, you know, that's who they cast, because he was going to be good in the role or whatever, but it was just an interesting connection that I'd never even heard of before. I thought somebody would have mentioned it. You know, I mean, these are really famous ones because they're really accessible. Like, Criterion's probably had out, what, 4 editions of them. So, I can't imagine... My problem with Criterion is, we watched the Criterion this time, and I had some problems with the translations. Because I'm not sure gamblers really... maybe that's what they were. Maybe that was the correct term, but I didn't know the context. I mean, if that...
Yeah, it seemed odd that these two gangs were described... They referenced early on to gambling, bringing... I think it's in the scene with the farm boy who wants to join one of these gangs. And they're saying that gambling will bring you to ruin.
And it's... Yeah,
I was thinking, you know, gambling, but there's no gambling depicted anywhere else in the movie. No betting. It's implied, but you know, they seem to have other pursuits in their criminal activities, like the sake and
silk. Yeah, there's this whole thing about how the whole plan is to get a silk festival there, and then have the attendees gamble. Is sort of mentioned at one point in sort of a throwaway scene, but they refer to those, the bad guys, as gamblers the whole time, and I just kind of wonder if that's maybe too literal of a translation, because we don't understand the context of how they're using that term, regardless of if that's the correct translation. So, but I wish Criterion would have more fun and maybe try and include the dub track. Because can you imagine watching this dub
Yeah, just like, some TV actors from the 50s.
Yeah, it would have just been amazing. I mean, it would have just been like... It would have been unbelievable. And the other thing is...
Thick, like, Bronx accents from New York Actors Academy.
It just New York, would have been...
Playhouse 90.
Oh, man. It would have been something. And it's... yeah, I mean, it's just a nice, fun couple hours, which is sort of interesting. Because it's so... I mean, there is a lot of time spent on it. You would never look at it and think that Kurosawa didn't take it seriously. Just the way the leaves follow Mufone around.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that at the end. I mean, that was really impressive, and there's really no... that's sort of... I don't think I've ever seen that really before, because they established that the wind... It's a very windy town at one point in the dialogue. They established that, and then there are leaves on the ground, and toward the end... Mufone is walking, and he walks in sort of a half moon, and the leaves follow him. The wind follows him with the leaves, and it's not like there's no implication that he's some supernatural visitor because he's the protagonist. It's not like Pale Rider, where he's the Pale Rider was the one where Clint Eastwood's the angel or something, right? He was the priest who disappears at the end. And then High Plains Drifter is the one where he's the guy come back from the dead, even though he looks different. He doesn't look like Buddy Van Horn anymore. He looks like Clint Eastwood. So this doesn't have anything like that, because it opens with Mufone. I mean, it's clearly him, and he shows
up. it ends on a very glib note. Pretty much, he tells the farm boy who joined the clan to go home and live a long life eating gruel, which is what which is what he was advised to do. And then he tells the other guy, he says, "Hey, yeah, well, he's happy to see him." He says, "Go hang yourself." And then he turns to the old shopkeeper and he says, "Yeah, it should be quiet around here now. Okay, bye." And he starts on the trail out of the village.
And we don't even get to see some wide shot of him.
it's just the last shot, it's his back walking away.
Yeah,
it's like a shot of his back and he's walking away. Like, oh man, it's so casual.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird because I guess we've sort of gotten to the point where these very assured...
It's not even like... It's like it's like he does this epic stuff, but it's Kurosawa refuses to turn him into someone larger than life. He keeps him kind of grounded.
Yeah, it's a very grounded thing. With the sets are all very not claustrophobic, really, but they are contained. There are no sweeping shots of things. Even though there are lots of crane shots, you never get really outside of the main street of the town.
Right.
And I was thinking about the way he reacts to helping the woman and the child.
Mm-hmm.
There's the moment where the shopkeeper sort of admires him for it, and he gets even more upset than he usually is.
Hey, you're not such a bad guy after all. You only pretend to be, or something like
and
that.
And Mufone sort of yells at him and tells him to get more sake or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just kind of... And then that sort of comes back a little bit later, but he's not at all... There's no implication of why he's helping the woman... And I swear there's at least an implication that in the Clint Eastwood one that he's doing it because he identifies with the kid, like, this is what happened to the man with no name, type thing. And there's nothing like that. It's just, you know, he just does it and off they go. And he does it, that's the same day, you know, as he first encounters her, as he just takes care of this situation as soon as he can. He just takes care of all of it. And
He's like the Three Stooges in their altruistic episodes.
But it's kind of weird because it's
we gotta help that old lady.
Yeah. He doesn't put any more weight on it than, somebody else would helping the blind guy cross the street in... that was in...
As long as it's not W.C. Fields.
Right, exactly. As long as it's not W.C. Fields. But the pacing, the plotting of it's just so interesting because this is not a major plot point. It's just something that happens as part of the narrative. I mean, shows up in the town. It's about the movie's framed by him showing up in the town and him leaving the town. And anything that happens in between is sort of gradual. And now, I mentioned this, I think, maybe last time. Or two times ago, because last time was the Halloween 2 commentary. And everyone should go out and buy Halloween 2 on DVD and not go see the movie because you should want the Weinstein Company to go out of business. Which basically, I guess, is mean, but, I guess I don't really want them to. But anyway, they've only made two movies in the last, 6 years, so it doesn't really matter.
But if you want to hear interesting information and laughs about Halloween 2 1981, check out last week's episode, the feature commentary, a very special episode. It was fun, and it's a free commentary, and there's never going to be a Rick Rosenthal, the director, doing a Halloween 2 commentary. So you
Rick
should listen
Rosenthal
to ours.
Should call us up and do a commentary with us where we interview him during the movie. Unfortunately, he doesn't have a website, so we can't email him that suggestion. But this is based on, I guess I said it was based on The Glass Key, the movie, but I guess it's actually based on the Red Harvest, which was a Dashiell Hammett novel that basically followed the same idea. The guy makes the two crime gangs go up against each other. But the Glass Key movie from, I think, 42 or 43, and I can't remember who directed it, but it was one of the Veronica Lake, Alan Ladd ones.
Oh, like This Gun for Hire?
Yeah, it was the one they made after This Gun for Hire before The Black Dahlia. The scene in Yojimbo where he escapes and crawls under the planks of the town. Supposedly, that's like a shot for shot remake of the Glass Key escape scene with Alan Ladd, but I don't remember it. And so that's sort of the lineage of
the East West lineage is strong with Kurosawa also because. He did a straight adaptation of American crime novel. I think that was High and Low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, was it Ed McBain or the guy who wrote as Ed McBain?
It was a big name like that.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Well, it was a good movie. Thanks for recommending it. Next week, we're going to be talking about, the epic, our bad movie will be an epic flop, you could say, but a high profile exploitation flop. Although, can any exploitation movie really be considered a failure? Because even Caligula, 1979, Malcolm McDowell.
That would be something.
but Peter O'Toole. An equally effeminate fop, and some great production values, and a lot of sex because it was produced by the publisher of Penthouse, Bob Guccione. It was written by Gore Vidal.
It was written by Gore Vidal, and I just, when we decided to watch it, I saw some thing about how McDowell and Helen Mirren do audio commentaries for it still. Which no one can understand because they're commenting on, the porn scenes they're not in. But apparently, McDowell said that if it was 1977 and Gore Vidal wanted you to be in his movie, you didn't say no. And here's what I'm thinking. Were there any good Gore Vidal movies? Didn't he write Myra Breckinridge or whatever the one is? Where it's the sex change movie with Raquel Welch. It's supposed to be terrible. I don't think that he was known for being a good screenwriter.
Well, he was one of those like good writers who entered Hollywood and was therefore presumed a good screenwriter because he was a hero of the counterculture and he was going to bring that counterculture edge to big Hollywood productions. He's like Terry Southern, you know.
Yeah.
Or our good movie is horror movie, which we haven't I think seen yet. Hour of the Wolf, Ingmar Bergman, who we mentioned earlier, a horror movie. I think it was made 62, actually, something like that. And it's about a guy who's having a bad night, I think.
It's Max Van Sydow.
He can't get to sleep, and we sort of follow him in his restlessness, and it's a horror movie.
And I'd never heard of this, actually.
Even the title?
No, I had no idea what you were recommending. That's why I was so surprised that it was Bergman. It's Bergman's only horror film, but it's like there's.
I think it's supposed to be a bit like Polanski's Persona, or
Persona's supposed to be a bit like Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, or Repulsion.
Right.
Horror movies like that, I guess, where it's one person in an empty place, kind of losing it.
Which is lots of other Bergmans, only without a supernatural element. But what's kind of interesting about it is when I looked it up, it was released on, it's out on a special edition DVD now, I think from MGM, as opposed to Criterion, who has every single other Bergman movie, I think. And so maybe that's, it's kind of weird when you
Maybe that means it's the most commercial thing he ever did.
It probably means that MGM handled the domestic distribution back then, so yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm not really looking forward to Caligula, but at the Alex Smithy podcast, we do the bad movies are not necessarily for us. They're for the listener.
Exactly. So we'll see you next time, and in the meantime, if you haven't yet, check out our Halloween 2 commentary. Check out our WordPress site at allensmithypodcast.wordpress.com. Leave us iTunes comments.
We'd love to hear from you.
If you even have suggestions for movies to be reviewed, we'd love to hear those.
The suggestions would be nice, actually. That'd be cool. Because I always like suggestions.
It's fun to be subjected to something and not really see it coming. And slavery is happiness, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So bow down before the one you serve, and we'll see you next time. This isn't. I've been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
This has been Alan Smithy Podcast. Thanks for listening.